This is a continuation of our conversation about the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible, as you've been discovering. Another name for that is the Torah. We are kind of moving from talking about whole books to talking about some themes this week. And so this week we have some really big themes, these ones here: holiness, purity, sacrifice, and tabernacle. And really the reason why we're talking about these as one clump is because they all hang together. The goal of the Torah, the goal of the book of Exodus, the story of Exodus, the story of the Bible overall is about how God wants to dwell with his people. And God has a plan for how his presence can provisionally dwell with Israel, and it has to do with these four things here: holiness, purity, sacrifice, and tabernacle. And so I want to explore those ideas today together here. And what I would love to do is, if you have thoughts or comments, like raise your hand or interrupt me, because I'd like you to get into the conversation on it. Because if I don't sense that you want to talk, I'm just going to keep talking, because there's a lot of stuff that I want to say, and you don't all want that. So, yeah. So let's talk about holiness for a second here. How would you describe, or how would you define holiness? Anybody want to give a attempt at this? Okay, in the Christian sense, we've discovered that being Christ-like is about holiness, right? Okay.
Otherness.
What was that?
Otherness.
Otherness. I think that's about as good as we can do in some cases, right? Holiness is by definition something that is beyond definition, right? It is other than what we are. There is no comparison. Like for everything else that we have in the world, there's like something you can compare something to. When you talk about holiness, you're talking about that quality of God to which there is nothing to compare. Okay, so it is other, transcendent, different. Okay. So,
could it be transcendent, or could it be other as in an ant is other?
What do you mean?
Like something can be other and kind of pictured and gross and small, or does holiness always mean transcendent?
In association with God, because it's associated with God, we always think of it as transcendent, as something as great, not just weird or different, but like other in the mysterious, unspeakable sense, yeah. So maybe the best example we have is if you want to have an analogy of this, is the sun, which is not other because it's part of the material universe and it exists alongside us here. The sun is necessary for life. Without the sun, no life could exist on the planet. Yet, if you come close to the sun, you will be incinerated. Right, Sean's face could tell us a little bit about this. He got a little sun yesterday, so he didn't get incinerated, but he did get a little bit of the heat there. Right, so now the sun will incinerate you, not because the sun is like mean or because it's threatened by you, but because it is so intense in and of itself. Right, like it's not like vindictive, like we're going to get you. The sun rays. Even from a distance, we have to handle the sun very carefully, even though it's 93 million miles away. We wear a sunblock most of the time when we think about it, and so that its presence doesn't burn us right where we are here. Now, imagine if the sun was going to make a little spot for itself to do its thing on Earth, like it was going to come close. How would that work? Right? Like, I mean, obviously, it couldn't work because the sun is massively larger than the Earth. It's 109 times the diameter of the Earth. I had to look some things up here. Its mass is 330,000 times that of the Earth. But imagine if some of the intensity of the sun was to come and to make its home on a particular place on Earth. If you know anything about the sun, which I don't know very much, but because I looked at a Wikipedia article, I know just a little bit. It is a constant hydrogen and helium fusion explosion, just like going on and on and on continuously. For reference, by the way, the only way of doing a hydrogen fusion on the planet that we know of right now is what is called a hydrogen bomb. You know what a hydrogen bomb is? Like, makes a pretty big explosion when you do something with that. So, nuclear power, which runs some of the electrical grid, is actually doing something the opposite, apparently. And maybe our physicist in house here, Mark, can clarify this. But I think it's nuclear fission, right? It's bringing things together, whereas fission is separating. Whereas nuclear fusion is bringing two things together, right? Am I getting that right? Okay, all right, good. Anyway, the point is that when we're dealing with anything like the sun, we do it like in the most carefully controlled environments imaginable. So when if you worked at a nuclear power plant or a nuclear facility, you'd have huge amounts of safety protocols, special suits to be in close proximity. You could only be in that proximity for a small amount of time without it becoming radioactive in some way or another. So now if you transfer that back to God's holiness, which again, it's not an exact you know, obviously one for one here, but just think about how complicated it is to be in God's presence as something that is vastly more intense and more potent than the sun itself. Okay? Does that kind of make sense where I'm going with this here? Okay, so the Bible makes it clear that to be in God's presence is to be in the presence of something that is massively potent, intensely good, but fearsomely dangerous in a sense. God's presence must be rightly contained or rightly dealt with. And in particular, there are several things that are a problem to God dwelling with his people. They are impurity, which we'll talk about in a second here. That's this idea of purity here. And then this other idea here of sin, which is more broadly broken down into three different words in the Hebrew, which we translate, as you see in the Bible, as iniquity, which is really about the behavior that is crooked. So like you cheat somebody on something, or you do something deceptive or dishonest, there's iniquity in that. Sin, which is kind of the general category that we talk about, but that's actually just one of the words in the Old Testament, is about missing the mark. It's about moral failure. Transgression, which is a word that none of us really use, right? Like you don't say, like, you transgressed against me. You know, like I never yet to hear somebody say that. But transgression is really, we use that the more ancient word in English of trespass when we say, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us in the Lord's Prayer. This is about violating relationship. It's about betrayal. It's about rebellion. And so this has a covenantal structure to it. So when someone does a transgression, it's they violated some sort of relational covenant. Does that kind of make sense? Okay. Any comments or thoughts or questions so far about what we're talking about? Yeah, Nathan.
These different kinds of sin, is that in the Old Testament or kind of a difference between Hebrew and Greek?
This is just from the Old Testament, these three categories. And in fact, I think you can see this. I didn't check this out myself in the Hebrew, but in like Psalm 32, which is a famous psalm of confession, they outline the three different kinds of, like, you can see confession along the lines of those three different words, which is interesting. So you'll see sometimes they come and clump together. Forgive us our iniquities and our sins and our transgressions, you know, kind of thing. Yeah, right. Ben.
So sin in the general sense, is that more a matter of, like, the purity laws, not adhering to the purity laws closely enough?
Okay. So now you're getting into the question, right? Which is, what is the difference between purity and the purity ideas and the ideas of sin, and how do they relate to each other? And those are important. It's an important question because they do relate to each other, but impurity is not the same thing as sin directly. So one way to look at it, as I broke it down in your little outline here, I don't know if you've seen that, but is impurity what you could think of as matter out of order. And sin is morality out of order. Okay, so roughly. I mean, this is a generalization here. So what I want to do is I want to look at the idea of purity in a second here one of the handouts there. But I want to mention that the whole way this relates is about proximity. So if you think of like God's presence as like, you know, like a nuclear facility or something like that, there are certain things you can't bring in close to that presence, and so it can function somewhere isolated. So God is trying to bring his presence into the camp, and so the camp has to become a place which is suitable for his presence. And that's what this is about, and that's about impurity and about sin. So let's look at this outline here, or this page here called Understanding Purity here, and then on the back side there's this diagram here. So I want to help us to get to something about purity, because we're likely to misunderstand this idea. In our culture, purity is almost always about germs, right? Like if you think of something that's impure, you're like usually thinking of it as like for instance, Nathan has a pacifier, and if it drops on the sidewalk, we don't pick it up and put it back in his mouth because we're like, there's all sorts of crazy stuff on the sidewalk in San Francisco. We don't know what's on the sidewalk there. So there's an impurity factor that is about the microorganisms. Now, in ancient Israel, that is not the lens that they're thinking about. They don't even know about microorganisms, so they're not concerned about the germ theory. Every single culture in the world, anthropologists will tell you, have what is called a purity code. And that has to do with the right order in which things happen and the right way to handle. Everything has a place, and its place should be, like, you know where that place is, okay? So in the Bible, in biblical language, I'm going to go through this here. Biblical language of holy, clean, pure, undefiled, unblemished, sanctified, saints, unholy, unclean, pure, impure, defiled, common. All this stuff is about an understanding of purity. Anthropologically speaking, there's these things called purity codes. Purity has to do with drawing the lines that give the definition to the world around us. Distinguishing, for example, what belongs to an individual from what belongs to others. So, for example, you have a sort of personal sense of like what people can touch on you, right? They can touch your arm, that's okay, maybe, but there's certain places that should not be touched, actually, right? Because they violate some part of your identity and your boundary. And so we have this that's not related, it's not related to germs, right? It's just like, you don't touch that. Like, it's not appropriate.
Not yours to touch.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's clearly defined. And in fact, you could be put in prison in our culture for touching the wrong place on somebody else. You know, I'm sorry, that's kind of crass, but that's what we're talking about here, right? Okay. Now, it also relates to communities as well. So it's not just the individual bodies have like boundaries, but communities have boundaries as well too. And how do you know whether you're in or outside of a community? Well, that's along the lines of a purity code of some kind or not. Okay. So there's a famous anthropologist. Her name is Mary Douglas, who did a ton of research on this. And I read this really obscure book by her a few years back. And I love her definition of dirt, which is so interesting. She says dirt is just matter out of place. Like dirt in the field is great. You can't grow something without dirt. You need dirt out in the field. Like you need your plants need to have soil. Dirt on your pillow, a problem, right? So what is impure about that? Well, the purity code that's been broken is the dirt's in the wrong place. The dirt's not bad in and of itself. It's just not in the right place, right? Food is great on the plate. Food is great in the stomach. Food is not great when it comes back out of the stomach onto the plate. Like you have to like get things in the right order or else you've done something that's weird. Now, we're not just talking about germs there, right? There's something gross to us. So when you come across the sense of like, ugh, you're often encountering a purity code of some kind, like a taboo that's in our society. Now, Americans and Westerners like to think that they've kind of graduated out of taboos, that it's not true. We have all sorts of taboos, right? And they're not just around germs, there are other things as well too, but we don't see them because they're like intuitive to us already, right? But you have to, that kind of gut reaction is telling you there's a purity code issue there, okay? So, is this making sense so far? Okay, so clean refers to, biblically speaking, anything or any person in a normal state. That which is clean may be thought of as that which is in its proper place within the boundaries established by God in creation, whose own external boundaries are whole and intact. Clean is about wholeness, okay? So now, here's some of the things that begin to be problems here. Sexual abominations, idolatrous rites, unauthorized rituals, ingestion of what is abominable, the amassing of pollutions without their timely purgation do not merely bar one from access to the temple, but threaten the very security of the nation in its land. So, back to this sheet here. I'll just read this to you. It's fascinating that when you come into the middle of what is the purity code for Israel here, God says, if you do this wrong, if you defile the land, this is from Leviticus 18, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you. And then the next chapter, or chapter and a half later, keep all my decrees and laws and follow them so that the land where I am bringing you will you to live may not vomit you out. There's like a really violent image there of like the land, because the land is what? It's holy land, right? It's been the land that is claimed for God, and so it can't handle the impurity, and so it will vomit the people out of it who are not going to live purely. Isn't that interesting picture and language there? Okay. Okay, so here are some of the things that are non-prohibited pollutions. Now, not all pollution, again, is sinful. This is what Ben was asking about. There's sinful things, and then there's just pollutions that happen, right? So childbirth is a way of becoming polluted. Why? Can we think about that for a second? Anybody have, this is a little graphic here. Okay, if clean and is about being whole and about boundaries being preserved, what happens in childbirth?
Everything comes out.
It's like, there's like blood and fluids and like another person comes out, a whole, it's just like this very, don't think microscopically again about microorganisms. It's just the boundary of a person has been like burst open in a sense. And so a mother is considered unclean for a certain amount of time, okay? Contact with a corpse Now, a lot of what you see here on the backside here, I'm showing you, this is these diagrams that I worked on and I'm really excited about. You probably won't care about them. But anyway, on the bottom here, this one here, the holy, profane, common, clean, and unclean. So if you think about the arrow to the far left-hand side there, in general, here's how the purity code works. Things that are ordered relate to life. When things are ordered well, things flourish, right? When if your tissues are ordered correctly, they keep producing more tissues, rightly, okay? Disorder, though, is about death. And so when you come into contact with a corpse, you're coming into a contact with tissues that have become disordered, roughly speaking. Now, so things that are unclean are going to count in that category. Were you going to say something? Oh, okay. You just, so God is the source of life. God is the essence of life. In his essence is life itself. And that's why holiness is associated with life and order. Does that make sense? Okay. So things can, you can see the arrows there going up. Things from an unclean state can be purified and cleansed. Usually that's through confession. There's like a confession that can be made, or some sort of ritual practice, like a ritual rinsing, or a certain amount of time, or a sacrifice can be offered in order to bring things into a new state here. Okay, things that are common and clean can be made to be holy by being hallowed, by being dedicated, by being consecrated. Those are all the same idea. You can set aside something for God. So like you could make like an instrument to be used in the temple, let's say, and then like after it's been pounded and, you know, made with this metal work or whatever, then you take it, you have a special ceremony to consecrate it to God, and then it belongs and it is now holy. Okay, in the same way, things that have been made holy can be desecrated, can be blasphemed or profaned, and then they can be put into what we considered a unclean state. So sin, iniquity, transgression, disregard of instruction about how things should be done, a failure to distinguish between what is common and what is profane, what is clean, what is unclean. This is what the priests were told to do in Israel, is to keep this order. So an example of this is in Leviticus 10, I believe it is. Aaron's sons are like freshly made priests, and they're like some of the first priests to be doing their thing, and they decide to disregard the instructions about how God said to do the censing of the temple, and they bring what's called unholy fire into the temple. I don't know exactly what happens. I can't remember now. Maybe it doesn't even clear in the text, but somehow or another what they did is they disregarded altogether God's instructions about how to do this. And this very strange story ends with these guys dying because they have done something. They've brought this like uncleanness into the most holy place. And there's like what one author calls the unclean holy fusion reaction, which is a kind of, you know, interesting way to talk about it. You see this also with, like, you remember when Uzzah reaches out and touches the ark? When they're transporting the ark, there's some moments in the biblical story that seem like, whoa, what happened there? And it's because something unclean comes into the presence with something that is holy, the most holy, and there's like a reaction. It's like if you like entered into the sun, you know, like we talked about earlier, you'd incinerate in some sense. And so this is all part of helping Israel understand the otherness and the holiness of God. Okay, in the top diagram here, this might be helpful to know as well. When you think about Israel, what you're looking at is you're looking at degrees of holiness. Don't think of holy here in the sense of virtuous. Think of holy in the sense of people who are in proximity to God, okay? Because we don't really believe that the Levites and the priests were more holy or more virtuous necessarily than the other Israelites, but they had been set aside by God to be closer. So starting at the outer edge there, I have a dotted line there. And there's something that you discover later on that are called God-fearers. This is in the New Testament. You see this language here. God-fearers are Gentiles who are close to Israel. They honor and worship Israel's God, but they have not been circumcised and joined the Jewish community. So that kind of dotted line out there is like one edge of that there. Then within that, there's a clear boundary of who is Israel. The 12 tribes, you're only part of the 12 tribes if you are actually circumcised and participate in the life of Israel. And and then within that, then there's a tribe that's been set aside, the tribe of Levi. And remember, I think I showed you this last week, the way the camp was set up, there was the temple here. And then all around the temple, the Levites had their tents to kind of like put a barrier there. And then the other tribes were sort of out here. So I'm roughly doing that with this diagram here. And then within the tribe of Levi, it was only Aaron and his sons that were actually priests. It wasn't all the Levites that kind of went in and out and were priests in the temple. And then within that, there was one who was elected to be high priest, and that high priest went into the actual most holy place once a year. So you see all these places here. The kind of hot spot of God's presence was the Ark of the Covenant. You guys, I remember the Indiana Jones and... okay, so that famous scene where they open the ark and like all their faces melt off, right? Like okay, so this is, you know, Hollywood's attempt to try to express the vast power that was understood to be in the ark there. And so the little place above the ark was like this thing like this, and then there was these like angels here that were like hovering here over these cherubim. This was called the mercy seat, and this was like right here was like the hot spot of God's presence. Okay, so if you were in Israel in the most holy place, this is where God was said to dwell. And so all these protections were put in place to put like barriers to keep this from like basically like incinerating the camp in a sense, right? That's what this diagram is all about, is those layers of holiness here. Okay, so back to the other side of the sheet here. So we were talking about childbirth, talking about contact with a corpse, an irregular or menstrual discharge, nocturnal emission, contact with a person who is with such a discharge, the secondary pollutions here, sexual intercourse. Again, all these things are about the boundaries of the body being sort of becoming a little wonky, right, in some way or another. Or contact with dead, with death itself. None of these are like sinful. They only just require a ritual process, like some sort of a ritual process to be put back into a state of cleanliness. Okay. Then there are these prohibited ones here. If you intentionally delay with your cleansing ritual, then that's when you move into a state of sin. This is what you were asking about earlier, Ben. Like, what's the relationship here? So there are permitted pollutions, and then if you don't go through the process correctly, but you maintain yourself in a state of uncleanness, then, like intentionally so, then you've moved into a state of willful disregard of God's instruction. And that would be considered sinful in that case. Corpse pollution for priests. Now, because priests are the people who are regularly interacting here in the holy place and in the temple compound, they can't have contact with corpses without going through an extended period of cleanliness. Because again, you're talking about life and death, and holiness is related to life, and death is related to uncleanness. Defilement by association with idols. Obviously, this is a big no-no. If you handled idols, you were handling like another, like a false god situation. Again, it's kind of like that. Murder, neglect of circumcision, defilement of what is sacred. And then there's some secondhand pollutions here. Now, sexual pollutions are interesting here. One of the key things you'll find if you read through Leviticus is that in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, you have major sections dealing with what are considered to be inappropriate sexual relations. And then right in the middle of that is Leviticus 19, which is this chapter in which we get the very important commandment to love one another, to love your neighbor as yourself, actually. So this is all part of God's holiness code. Now, question. Why might sexual behavior in particular be an issue with related relationship to holiness? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Sorry, you said sexual behavior?
Yes. Okay, yes. So, if God is the creator of life, God is the source of life, from him emerges all life, what is the thing that humans do that is maybe most closely associated with God in that sense? Well, it is reproductive life. It's the way we handle our reproductive organs, in a sense. It's the order of how creation happens. You remember in Genesis, the image of God is male and female together, right? Which, again, produces another other, right? We talked about this before last summer. Hey, Nathan. So, does that make sense at all? Why holiness and sexuality might be closely associated with each other? It's not just random. God doesn't just pick, like, this thing, sex, and I'm going to make this a big deal. It's that sexuality is tightly connected to God himself. And so how God orders sexuality is very important because it relates to holiness. And you see in the New Testament, Paul makes a statement in 1 Thessalonians. He says, I forget the exact language here, but he says basically this is your... this is like your focus with regard to holiness. And he goes right into a whole section about sexuality there. People ignore that. They don't really want to talk about that. So, yeah. Any thoughts or comments on that? Yeah, Mark.
In that list that you give, it doesn't mention intercourse with someone who is not your spouse. Was that not prohibited?
It is prohibited. So later on, there's a word called fornication, or what we translate fornication, porneia, in Greek. And that is kind of a catch-all word that has to do with any kind of sexuality, any kind of sexual expression that is not within the bonds of a covenanted husband and wife situation there. In the Old Testament, there seems to be like a kind of like, there's like a working out of this. Like there's condemnation of prostitution and there's condemnation of adultery, but then there's this kind of like space that seems not quite as clear about what happens with someone who's not married, it's not a prostitute. But there is all this stuff in the Torah about if you have sexual relations with someone like that, then you need to like pay her father and marry her and bring her into your family. You can't just like have these unaffiliated sexual encounters. So yeah, that would be included in that whole idea there of proper sexual behaviors. But it's not spelled out specifically in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, as far as I know. Any other thoughts on that? Okay. Alright, so back to this idea of the impurity here. Are you getting a little bit of a sense of how the purity code works? So, to go back to our image here of Israel and the nation, so this is Israel here, and this is the nations here. One of the things that you notice that God is doing with a purity code that he gives to Israel is he is thickening up this boundary here. So how does he do that? Well, he does it in lots of different ways. He gives them a specific calendar that they are supposed to like go together and build a culture around. He gives them, and this is where some people get confused, he gives them specific dietary instruction. Do you remember last week we talked about how the Torah is broken down into various categories, and one of them was the chazim, which are like the commandments that Jewish people go, well, we don't have a good rational explanation, but God told us to do it, so we're going to do it. That would be the clean and unclean animals. Why can you not eat pork, but you can eat goat meat? Well, again, this is a really important thing because what it ends up doing is it's very difficult to have fellowship across international or across ethnic boundaries if you can't actually eat together. And so one of the problems that you see with Israel early on is they're this people group that's not very well defined. They've come out of Egypt. They don't even know what their boundaries really are. And God thickens up their boundaries. And the first part of Israel's story, maybe the first 500 or 1,000 years of their story, they seem to have a trouble with always wanting to like run to their neighbor's gods. They always are trying to get confused with like who they really are. So they're polytheistic in many cases. They bring in other idols. They intermarry. And so all these things are things that God is like trying to like prevent making them a distinctive community by building a thick barrier around the edge of them here. Do you see why that might be important? Okay, I'm thinking about my son Nathan. So like when he goes to school at some point, I want him to know that he's a Christian and not just like a part of the broader culture. And if he doesn't have a thick enough distinction of his identity as a Christian, then he will likely find himself confused and that sort of things. Now, on a much bigger and broader level, this is what's happening with God's people. He is dragging them out of slavery, making them a people for himself, but they're often more likely to want to run off and do their own thing. Does that make sense at all? What kind of thoughts or questions come to mind about this? Like, I'm curious what you're thinking about it all. Yeah, Mark.
Contact with a non-Israelite, an impure action.
No, not necessarily. So, Later on, okay, so after, I'm fast-forwarding the story. So the way the Israel story goes is you have like the Exodus here going forward, then you have eventually what's the monarchy, where David reigns over the whole nation, and then Solomon, and then the story splits into two groups here. You have the northern kingdom, and you have the southern Judah and the southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And then what you end up happening in both of these stories here is something called the exile. The exile is a big, essentially when God says to the people, you've been pining after all your neighbor's gods, you've been pining after all their practices, okay, I'll go ahead and send you into their backyard. Why don't you go and spend the, you know, maybe like, you know, 40 or 50 years, 70 years in their backyard and see how it feels. This is like my interpretation. So then after the exile, this group is totally obliterated. They don't ever return, actually. The northern tribes are, the one thing that we have from this is what is called the Samaritans. The Samaritans are a mixed breed of northern tribes plus other people that have mixed together with them. That's why in the New Testament, these are kind of like half-breeds. So we're like, we don't handle them. The southern kingdom, Judah, comes back, and then they really have a huge emphasis on purity. On the purity laws. They don't intermarry. In the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, all of a sudden, the boundaries like that God had put for them get thicker and higher. Not because God told them to, but because they get really, really concerned about the fact that they have lost their identity too many times. And so in the New Testament era, you see stuff about how Jews won't even go into a Gentile's home because that might make them impure. So that's actually not God's instruction. That's what the return from exile community decided. To reinforce those boundaries even more, they made them even higher themselves, to put a thicker wall between them and the nations. Now, when you get to Jesus' time, Jesus does go and hang out with Gentiles very regularly as part of his ministry, actually. He heads up into Gentile territory, spends time with them. And then you see in the New Testament that God is actually deconstructing the barrier between Jew and Gentile in order to create one new community around Jesus. And this is the major story of the New Testament, is how does the boundary, the barrier that was put in place, that God put in place in the Torah, get reconstructed in a new way around the Jew plus Gentile community. Does that make sense? Yeah, Nathan, go ahead. Yeah,
when you just said what kind of questions arise when we see God building this barrier, one question I thought is, well, I tend to think of you know, cultural codes about what's dirty or what's pure as like pretty conventional, and
yeah.
So I can, and that it can change over time. So I wonder, oh, did God mean for that to be permanent for them, or for it to be some guidelines for a few hundred years and then they could shift or not? And yeah, so I don't really know the answer to that, except it seems like with Jesus that a lot of that was deconstructed, or I don't know what you mean to say.
Yeah, so the purity code was reconstructed around Jesus himself for the New Testament Christian community. Now, I want to say something really interesting that I think is helpful for us to see. Because you might think that God was sort of backwards and like, why did he make this like weird cultural separation? One of the things that's amazing is that this tiny little fraction of a percentage of the world's population, the Jewish people, still exist as a people group, right? How is it that without a nation of their own for like, what, 1800 years or some huge long period of time, I forget exactly how long it is, that they managed to create, to hold an identity that was separate from the people that they live with? They were in the backyard of every empire of the world, right? So somehow or another, the distinctiveness that God intended actually did preserve a people group. Now, there's all sorts of disputes about what the meaning of that is at this point in our era now. But I would want to say that for Christians, we also have a distinctiveness to our own community. And if you read the early church fathers, they're very big on emphasizing how it is that we are distinctive. And they have different markers for how we're distinctive than the Jewish ones. So again, the New Testament is all about this dispute about how to be distinctive. Is it along the lines of Torah? Particularly for Gentiles, and Paul's answer is no, it's not along the lines of these distinctive things that we have of food laws, Sabbath, kosher, etc. Those are not the ways that the body of Christ is defined. Paul goes and says, it's just fine if Jewish people want to keep on practicing this thing, as long as it doesn't disrupt their fellowship within the body of Christ with Gentiles. Like, there has to be a kind of like an appropriateness to that there. So I'm into the thick of a huge New Testament argument, but do you understand where that's going at all? Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Other comments or thoughts on this, Sarah? Okay, so the last thing that I want to shift towards then is, and I'm just giving you like big picture glimpse here, is I want to talk about sacrifice for a moment. So sacrifice is the way in which, one of the ways in which impurity and sin is made right, impurity is made pure and sin is made right. So I have this really, really microscopic print here because it all fits on one page. So you will need like a telescope or something like that just to see this here, a microscope. We're not going to go through all these because we don't have time to. But what I want to point out here is that there are essentially, what are there, 5 different types of sacrifice here. There is the burnt offering, which is, by the way, that word Holocaust that we have for what happened to the Jewish people in the 20th century is the exact same word for a whole burnt offering, which is a painful connection. Does that make sense? Like, this is, the Jewish people called it the Holocaust because they're like, it felt like we were like a burnt offering. Like, the whole of us got burned. You know, like, it was terrible. So that's what the burnt offering is, an animal that the whole thing is burnt. The cereal offering often came together with that, in which they would provide grain, and a symbolic portion went to the altar, and the rest went to the priests. The peace offering is a third kind of offering. This is what you hear, sometimes read as a fellowship offering or communion, or basically this is a free will offering in which people brought cattle, sheep, goats, and then the animal slaughtered. And part of it went to the Lord, part of it went to the priests, and then the rest of it had to be made into a community feast. So you can imagine if you had, like, say, like a cow, and you were offering this, you had to eat all the cow by the third day. Do you know how much meat is in a cow? A lot. You had to have a giant barbecue, a giant feast, and include everybody that you knew in that whole feast to like do this. And so there's some really beautiful pictures of what happens when you bring a free will offering here. Now, for me as a vegetarian, it's sort of a funny thing here. Yeah, I'm not invited to that one. Okay, then the purification offering. So then there is a clarification about what should be brought for that, depending on who you are. The blood is sort of put on the horns of the altar, and then there's some flicking of the blood onto the curtain of the temple, which is interesting. And then there's this other one called a reparation offering. The reparation offering is interesting here because, let me just say this. If you intentionally sinned, willfully like sinned, it's called sinning with a high hand. That's like, it's basically this picture. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but basically this picture, like, I don't care what you say, God, I'm going to screw you. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. There is no sacrifice for that. You're like, you're out of luck. Like, there's nothing you can do about that, actually. You're just in bad shape. Now, if you come to your senses before, like, the people discover that you've done this horrible thing, and you confess your sin, then that sort of high-handed sin is downgraded into like an unintentional sin. Because it's like you came to your senses, you didn't really mean to, in your better mind, you thought better of it, okay. Then there's a sacrifice for that. Now, if you like say stole your neighbor's cow, and you're like, took it to your house, and they caught you, again, that's sinning high-handed. You didn't come to your senses. There's no sacrifice for that. If you come to your senses and you're like, oh, I shouldn't have stolen the cow. What was I thinking? You give it back to them. Then you also have to give them 20% value in addition to that back with them as well, too. And then bring your sacrifice to the temple. Okay? So there's a kind of like reparational sense of what's happening here as well. So let's just talk for a moment about the idea of the logic of animal sacrifice. Because I think, again, this is another place where people are like, this is so backwards. Nobody kills animals. You know, like, this is a terrible thing or whatever. So I want to like kind of like suss out just a little bit about this idea. It was a tangible means. I'm on this sheet here, by the way, the front sheet that we started with. It was a tangible means of enacting reconciliation with God. And animal sacrifice exists as a part of a symbolic and sacramental world. So sacrifice, the animal sacrifices mean something in and of themselves, and you could say they point beyond themselves to invisible realities. In the same way that when we eat the bread and the wine, they are bread and wine, but we understand that we are receiving the body and blood of Christ. There's something broader and bigger and more mysterious happening here. Okay? So remember that God set this system up. It was not the Jewish people who were like trying to merely buy off God. They weren't like, well, I feel really bad, so I'm going to go kill something and like give it to God. God set this up. It also fits within a world in which everybody is practicing sacrifice. Like the ancient world, animal sacrifice was universal. Everybody did it. Sacrifice is a system that is based on faith. It is trusting that God actually forgives. Okay, God meets us in material ways, and this reveals the sacramental worldview here. Now, why animals? Animals were the primary source of transferable wealth in the ancient world. So you didn't really have like lots of silver and gold lying around. You had animals. Animals were how you stored your wealth. So the symbolism here is that sin is costly. It costs you something when you sin. Also, practically speaking, this is how the priests and the Levites made their livelihood. So when people brought a sacrifice, part of that went to the priest's family, and they actually got to keep that. Were you going to say something?
Well, I've always sort of... It's more than just the cost. It's the whole concept that sin is so bad that the cost is blood.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate sacrifice was the blood of the Messiah.
Right.
So I guess you're saying the same thing.
I'm getting there. I haven't finished that thought because there is something of that is implied in this here. It's not ever explicitly said, actually, interestingly. It's just implied. But, yeah. Okay, so just keep going down the outline for a second here. Animals were alive as opposed to, say, inanimate objects such as gold. That's an important piece here, and it gets to a little bit of what Diana's trying to say here. That this is a living thing. This is a life of some kind. Leviticus 17 explicitly says the blood of a creature is, or the life of a creature is in its blood. And that's why blood becomes so potent as a symbol. And if you think about the ancient world, like, you know, if you're like, this is graphic, but if like you saw somebody fall and gouge their jugular vein and blood gush out on the ground and they died, you would make the intuitive connection that they're no longer alive because their life flowed out of them. Right? Does that make sense? So this is like not like some weird thing here. As part of a sacrifice, every time an animal sacrifice, the Jewish people would offer an oblation. They would pour out all the blood of the animal. The blood was not theirs to have, actually. The blood belonged to God because the life belongs to God. It's not theirs. So the blood was poured out. And then there was this sense of like what Diana's saying here, life for life. There's this like substitutionary aspect here that is implied here. In fact, there's a part of the ceremony is that when someone brought their animal, they would put their hand on the head of the animal, they would rest and they would confess what had happened. It's almost like a transfer kind of idea going on there, although it's not explicit again. Then there's this flicking ritual where the curtain of the temple is flicked with blood. Now, why blood? Now, we think of blood as actually being corrupting. Like, when you think of, like, you have blood on your hands, we usually think of that as, like, I'm guilty and responsible for something. It's corrupt. Blood, however, was also seen, because it is life, as a detergent. A kind of detergent for, like, sin and the vandalism that builds up in a place where we have been impure and sinned. And so blood is seen that way, which is why it cleanses stuff. Another reason why animals were used is because they could be burned. You can't really burn like gold. It doesn't really do anything, right? In burning, there's something interesting that happens here. The animal is converted into another form. Like you actually see the smoke rising up into the heavens. There's a sense in which it is like transferring forms. Like this is moving into God's realm in some way or another. So it's kind of a tangible sense there. Does that make sense? It's kind of weird to talk about that, but anyway. In some types of sacrifice, animal meat provided the basis of a communal meal, as I said earlier. So the symbolism is that a meal brings parties together. There's emphasizes communion. There's reconciliation. God gets his part. The priests get their part. And the community has a feast. This is not so much in the case of sin. This is more in the case of a free will offering in which people are brought together in that there. So that's like some of the basic idea there of what a sacrifice does. And all this was happening in the context of a tabernacle. And so what happens then is, to round out the whole discussion here, is God says, I want to come and I want to dwell among you. I am holy. And to be in the presence of holiness requires a certain level of purity and morality. And so what happens when you fail at that? Well, then sacrifice becomes part of the answer to that. And so the temple complex was, or the tabernacle, was the means, the center by which God dwelled and by which sin was taken care of, by which impurity was dealt with. And so as long as that was operating, then God could dwell with the people. And what is said again and again in the Torah is, when this breaks down, there will come a point in which God will withdraw his presence, in which the land will vomit you out. Well, that's exactly what happens in the exile, is that generation after generation gets warned, you're doing things wrong, you're impure, you're not paying attention to the Lord, and eventually God withdraws his presence from the temple. The temple is destroyed completely. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians come in, they sack the temple, take all the stuff away, the exile people away, and it's only after the land has been given its Sabbaths, its rest that it never got, that then God restores people back to the land again. So this is kind of the logic of what's happening in the Torah. How do you feel? Is this overwhelming? Yeah, Jack.
Well, isn't it true that back in the good times, the other cultures of the world also had sacrifices, kind of a normative thing? It was to different gods. Their sacrifices were usually a lot more extreme. They were like, you know, human sacrifices.
Yeah.
I don't know if there was peaceful cultures back at that time, you know, in the Old Testament of the world. It seemed like every civilization, that would have been somehow familiar way of dealing with an appeasement to the gods or whatever.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So we have to be careful with that because we don't just want to lay that onto Israel and say what they're doing is appeasing an angry God.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that this...
It was commonly practiced.
This was a practiced thing throughout the world.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that child sacrifice was strictly forbidden. And in fact, God says in Jeremiah, he's like upset because Israelites have started doing this. He's like, this never even crossed my mind. Why would you do this? This is a horrible thing, right? So there's like boundaries to what God says can be done with sacrifice. So anyway, yeah, Benjamin, and then I realized we're past time. Sorry.
Prohibited pollution, what does that mean? Intentional delay of prohibited.
Okay, so if you had sexual relations and you're a married couple, you were unclean for a day. You had to go wash yourself and then couldn't go into the temple complex for one day. If you were like, I don't care, no biggie, then God says, you're disregarding my instructions about how to be made clean, okay? So that was part of that's when things became a problem. It's not that you became unclean, it's that you didn't regard God's instructions about how to become clean again. That make sense? Okay, all right, cool. Let's go ahead and stand up together, and we'll end with prayer.